Here's what Chris in Moab, Utah, had to say about last summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
I'm a new Lutheran, and I live in rural eastern Utah, which is the wilderness for someone like me. There aren't many confessional Lutherans around, so it was a great gift to share a weekend with like-minded people.
You can find out more about the 2016 Making the Case conference, Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th, in Collinsville, Illinois, at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Today, after completing this exhaustive process, I've made my decision. I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence. Today, I am nominating Chief Judge Merrick Brian Garland to join the Supreme Court.
That's President Barack Obama announcing this morning his nominee for the Supreme Court to fill Antonin Scalia's vacant seat, Merrick Garland. He referred to him in his remarks there at the White House as a consensus nominee. We're going to get some reaction to that and some updates on the November elections on this Wednesday afternoon, March the 16th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Joining us for an update on the November elections and a reaction to that nominee to the Supreme Court, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Wow, thanks for having me again.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome back.
It's great to be here with you.
Mark, first, your reaction to this morning's announcement from President Obama that Chief Justice Merrick Garland will be his nominee to fill Antonin Scalia's place on the Supreme Court. He referred to him, quoting Orrin Hatch, as a consensus nominee.
Yeah, the media will probably go out of their way to say that Merrick Garland is a quote-unquote moderate, and in some respects, that's how he's viewed. He's been on the D.C. Circuit Court for a while, and his decisions basically tend not to rock the boat of sort of, you know, existing Supreme Court precedent and some other things. So I think that a lot of people, you know, see him as being, you know, a business-as-usual kind of guy. The problem for Republicans is there are three distinct issues, I would say. One is that we're rapidly reaching a point where Republican voters especially are really sick of business as usual. And with the growth of the administrative state and an activist judiciary in this country, you know, a guy who's business as usual and just rubber stamping everything that comes through the courts or that, you know, the executive branch wants to do will have a lot of Republicans, you know, hopping mad as it is. The second issue is that he, of all the things where he's not particularly moderate on, he's really bad on guns. There's a lot of things that he's done that seem to indicate that he would be a vote to overturn the Heller decision. That was, you know, probably the most significant piece of significant court decision involving Second Amendment rights in recent years. And that alone might be enough to spur Republicans to oppose him. And further, interestingly enough, Obama is very, you know, pro-gun control, and he's actually even way to the left of the Democratic base on this. So if that becomes an issue in his nomination, it wouldn't bode well. The third issue here is that Garland is 62 years old, and that's one of the oldest Supreme Court nominees we've seen in a long time. So to some extent, Obama seems to be saying to Republicans, you have a choice here. You can take, you know, the 62-year-old so-called moderate, or you can wait around and roll the dice and see if, you know, a President Hillary nominates some, you know, crazy liberal, you know, 45-year-old justice that you're going to be stuck with for a lot longer, you know, if you can't adequately oppose that person. So that's pretty much the state of play as far as Merrick Garland is concerned. But regardless, I think the Republicans are going to hold fast to their previous principle of not going forward on any sort of nomination until the election.
Molly, should Republican senators, should they fight this nominee?
Well, I think that what they've done all along is what they should continue to do, and they have done a remarkably good job with it, which is to say, this is not about any particular nominee. We are in the middle of a hot election year. We don't have the time or the wherewithal to go through with this. We want to wait and let people decide who they're going to have as their president and let that person nominate a justice. And they've consistently said this isn't about the personality. Now, in this case, that this person is considered moderate says a lot about how really bad the judiciary is, because he's not that moderate. And Mark is exactly right. On gun rights, he actually served on the court through which the Heller decision came. That's the most important Second Amendment decision in recent memory. And he was on the wrong side of that. And he has had other bad statements that he's made on gun rights. That's a huge issue. And if this Republican Senate would allow someone like this to come through without at least trying for something better, and I know that the stakes are pretty high given who will likely be the nominees on both sides of the race, I just think it would so infuriate Republican voters that the senators don't really have an option about what to do. They just hold strong, stay firm, and if it comes to it that as the race continues, it becomes obvious that it would be better to approve this person, they will still have time in a lame duck session after November. So they have many options on the table. Everything they're doing is constitutional, despite what you hear from the media. The Constitution does say that the president nominates. The Senate has to give its consent before that nominee can be appointed. And it doesn't really say much about how they give that consent or how they don't give that consent. So everything they're doing is according to their own rules, all of which are fine and constitutional.
Molly, a lot happened yesterday evening. What did we learn from yesterday's election results?
Well, it was another exciting Tuesday night in 2016. So we got a lot of results from different states. Perhaps most importantly, Marco Rubio did such a tremendously bad job in Florida, failing to win more than one county. He won one county out of 67, I think it was. So he is now out of the race. And that's something he probably, you know, I think if people are not entirely surprised, that seemed to be the trajectory. But he's out. Governor Kasich won in Ohio, and he won pretty well there. And then other than that, there were a lot of races that involve a combination of winner-take-all delegates and congressional delegates. Donald Trump had a pretty good night, and Ted Cruz continues to hang in there. So other than Rubio getting out, not a ton about the dynamics of the race has changed.
Mark, same question to you. What struck you about last night's results?
Well, even though Trump obviously performed very well, the delegate math still is not great. I mean, it's doable for him to get the 1,237 delegates he needs to win the Republican nomination outright, but he still has to win 60% of the remaining delegates in order to do that. That's doable, but it is not necessarily an easy road to hoe either. Then again, in his favor, there are more winner-take-all contests going forward, so if he can continue to win, you know, an overwhelming number of the delegates, even at a, you know, plurality of 35-40%, then he, you know, might just pull it off. At the same time, as Molly pointed out, you know, the race is going to consolidate with Rubio getting out. So, you know, it's hard to tell whether or not that will benefit Cruz. There's some evidence to suggest that I think Republican primary voters, especially the ones that aligned against Trump, are starting to vote strategically. Even a lot of more moderate Republican voters who weren't especially enamored of Cruz and like Rubio as a more, quote, you know, typical GOP candidate in the vein of Romney or McCain, might just vote for the hardliner Cruz because they think that he has the best chance to beat Trump because that's an obviously superior alternative. And it'll be very interesting to see whether or not Republicans start voting strategically. And finally, the other issue that benefits Cruz, obviously, is with Rubio out of the race, there should be some consolidation. It just depends on how that plays out. But, you know, then again, there was crazy things happening still, like in Missouri, where Ted Cruz narrowly lost by 2,000 votes, but it was a race where 8,000 people still voted for Ben Carson. So it was just, you know, strange all around.
Molly, how do you explain Marco Rubio's failure?
Well, there are so many interesting things about Marco Rubio, and he's obviously a very good politician in many ways. He seems to have been running in the completely wrong race. He would have done so well in 2012. He would have done so well in 2008. Not that he would have been in a position to run in those. He has a message of optimism and hope and sort of a general greatness of the people that nobody wants to hear right now. People are angry. They're fed up. And you cannot fail to mention that he was on the wrong side of an issue, according to many Republican voters, on immigration. And this is a problem that the Republican Party has had for a long time, where they haven't permitted people to talk about immigration policy. They have shut down debate, they have shut down discussion, and they have forced through their idea, the elites in the Republican Party have forced through their idea of what immigration policy should be. And I think that really came and bit them in the end, because people finally said, enough is enough, we have to talk about this. So you see people who are concerned about immigration much more likely to support Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, and definitely not support Marco Rubio, who worked with Democrats on a comprehensive immigration reform bill.
Molly, I wonder, because there has been obviously no shortage of coverage of Donald Trump by the mainstream media, are they adequately covering conservative discontent with Trump? I'm thinking about George Will, Bill Kristol, Cal Thomas, Thomas Sowell, virtually everyone who writes for the National Review are opposed to him, and almost on a daily basis, putting it in writing. Are they covering this adequately?
I'm less concerned about whether they're covering those people who oppose Donald Trump than whether they're adequately covering the 60-70% of Republican voters who oppose Donald Trump. And that, to me, is just absolutely scandalous. The way that you see the media cover this story is, and of course, the Trump phenomenon is fascinating and interesting, and these people who support him deserve to be covered. It's just they don't deserve 80% of the coverage when they comprise such a small percentage of the Republican populace. So the way the media present it is as if all of the grassroots Republicans are all on the Trump Express and all of the elite establishment are not. That is just simply not true in either case. A majority of the grassroots are, in fact, opposed to Donald Trump. And you have plenty of establishment figures who have quickly gotten on board the Trump Express and a lot of the conservative commentariat and whatnot have. So the elite conservative commentariat. So you're not, they're totally misunderstanding the nature of the division, and they're doing a bad job of covering it, I think.
Mark, how do you explain the Trump popularity when a who's who of conservative thinkers are opposing his candidacy?
That is a really good question. I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what the future of the Republican Party is. I think that a lot of people who are, you know, even establishment figures who have made peace in terms of, like, you know, playing footsie with supporting Trump or supporting him outright, are doing so because they see him as something of a blank canvas in terms of policy and other things like that. And they think that if they can sort of get on board early, then they can actually have some influence that will do some good. And then I think some of them are just, you know, populist figures themselves. I mean, a lot of talk radio hosts and some other, you know, Fox News personalities have always been sort of distinctly populist and less ideological in certain ways. Trump is a very good vehicle for that. And then, you know, secondarily, you know, a lot of, you know, what goes on in politics these days, either be it media or outside of media, you know, involves cults of personality. And Donald Trump certainly is a big cult of personality that, you know, you could, you know, ride the coattails on. So, you know, there are there's a pretty wide variety of reasons, healthy and unhealthy, why people would support Donald Trump. As for opposing Donald Trump, you know, I think honestly, it's just there are two things. I mean, one is just that, you know, Trump doesn't represent any sort of principle conservative ideology, and to the extent that he tries to say that he does, he's unable to articulate it. And so there are a lot of people, I think, that, you know, are justly worried about that. And the other thing is, I think it's a personal moral issue. I mean, there's a lot of people that are saying, you know, how can I tell my kids I voted for this guy who brags about sleeping with married women and, you know, says all these nasty things about people and so on and so forth, to find the man repulsive personally. And so those are the things that he's got to overcome. But going back to what Molly was saying, I just wanted to say one thing, which is that the media has covered Trump a lot because his supporters have been very vocal about how angry they are. And I think that both the media and Donald Trump supporters are going to be in for a shock, because when he wins the nomination, they're going to find out that a lot of people in the Republican Party who oppose Trump are equally angry that he is their standard bearer all of a sudden. And I think people really aren't picking up that a lot of the Trump opposition, the never Trump people, are in fact really upset about the Republican Party being hijacked, and they're going to be vocal about it if it happens.
So much of the Trump campaign has been about burning down the Republican Party, and I don't even have a problem with that, because I think it's totally legitimate to be upset with how the Republican Party has handled its power in recent decades. But that has been the mood and the message of the campaign, this disdain for Republicans, this disdain for people who support the Republican Party, the disdain for Washington, D.C. types. And then today I noticed that a lot of the Trump, the vocal, prominent Trump supporters, the establishment figures, Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, Laura Ingraham, who's a big radio host and leader, they all started saying, okay, now's the time. We all have to rally around Donald Trump. And I thought, this is an interesting message. You start off by saying how much you loathe everybody else and how evil and awful and corrupt they are. And you get this plurality of the votes, and then you're like, okay, now join us. And I'm not entirely sure that message will work after having been treated so horribly. Every politician runs tough campaigns and speaks against their opponent, but this is kind of on just a fantastically different level.
Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard. We're getting our update on the November elections on this Wednesday afternoon, March the 16th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York. Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama. Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California. St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan. Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri. The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California. St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org and click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
No ditto heads allowed. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're getting our weekly update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, you have recently written about Jerry Falwell Jr. He's made a comparison of Donald Trump to the biblical King David. What did he say, and what do you think about it?
Yeah, something came to light recently where Falwell Jr. gave an interview to his student newspaper. He had the Liberty University. And the newspaper was very upfront about how upset his endorsement of Trump had made students and alumni and donors. And so he was giving an interview about that. And he, as part of his remarks, said that people need to understand the difference between a pastor and a politician and to remember that God said that King David was a man after his own heart. And here King David was a murderer and an adulterer. And when I saw these comments, you know, part of it I thought was very good and important. Evangelicals have tended to struggle to understand the distinction between a pastor and a politician, and these are two different vocations with different strengths and different things you should be looking for. The moral integrity that you're seeking in a pastor might not be present in someone who does make a good political leader. But it's also true that what he said about King David just totally missed the mark, because it is true that when God chose King David to take over as king, he said these things. It's true that later King David committed adultery horrifically and murdered the husband of the woman that he slept with and conceived a child with. And it's also true, though, and this is what Falwell didn't mention, that God sent Nathan, the prophet, to come and hold King David accountable. He tells him the story about a rich man who takes everything from a poor man. And King David says, this man should die. And Nathan says, that man is you. And David realizes what he has done. He confesses his sin. He is punished tremendously for what he has done. And he ends up writing these beautiful penitential psalms, including Psalm 51, which you hear If you're in a liturgical church service, you hear it every week. It's message of contrition, and this message of contrition and forgiveness and whatnot is what Jerry Falwell left out of that comparison with Donald Trump. Donald Trump, by comparison, has said that he doesn't ask for forgiveness because he doesn't believe he needs to. He would rather just not do anything wrong, and yet he's also been quite open about his numerous infidelities, sleeping with women who are married to other men, just sort of greed, corruption, all these things. We're all sinners. We all have these sins. But Donald Trump has been vocal about how he doesn't believe he needs to repent for his sins.
Bimbo.
Dog.
Fat pig.
Real quotes from Donald Trump about women.
A person who is very flat-chested is very hard to be a 10.
I'd look her right in that fat, ugly face of hers.
Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
She had the height. She had the beauty. She was crazy. But these are minor details.
I like kids. I mean, I won't do anything to take care of them. I'll supply funds, and she'll take care of the kids.
You know, it really doesn't matter what they write, as long as you've got a young and beautiful piece of ass.
That must be a pretty picture, you dropping to your knees.
There was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her... wherever.
Women, you have to treat them like
This is how Donald Trump talks about our mothers, our sisters,
our daughters.
If you believe America deserves better, vote against Donald Trump. Our Principles PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Molly, you've recently written about that ad, and you say it misses the mark on how to present Donald Trump to women.
Yeah, and I did get a lot of pushback when I wrote that. Clearly, Donald Trump has given so many statements that you can quote that just sound horrible. We were just subjected to 30 seconds of them. His discussions of women in particular are very bad. But my thinking on this is that in a Republican primary, this type of message, I'm not sure how well it works. Republican voters, I think, already know that Donald Trump is sexist and speaks this way, not just about women, but also he's very disdainful of men as well. And I wish that an ad that took on Trump mocked him more instead of was so serious. If you see the ad, you see that each of these women who are reading different things he said, they all kind of look sort of have the same general look. They all kind of look like they could be public school teachers. They're very serious and they're very upset. And I think that you absolutely have to consider that during a general election, this is what anti-Trump ads will look like for 6 months or whatnot. But I'm just not sure if it works so well among Republican voters who tend not to be so susceptible to the war on women messaging.
Mark, I got a question for you, and I've long said that, you know, I think a legal prerequisite for running for president of the United States, since the president's only oath is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, they ought to be able to demonstrate a working knowledge of the Constitution and, you know, maybe just be able to pass a pop quiz from high school on the basic contents of maybe even just the Bill of Rights. You know, that would satisfy me a little bit. And that's what concerns me the most about Trump. He seems to not even be aware that the Constitution exists. Why don't reporters start asking questions of Trump and other candidates about specifics in the Constitution bearing upon their positions?
As if reporters know anything about the Constitution.
Well, yes, that was exactly what I was going to say. The reality is that most Americans don't have any sort of good, you know, detailed working knowledge of the Constitution, how the separation of powers between the legislative branch and the executive is supposed to work, which is a huge problem with everything that's going wrong these days, and a whole host of other constitutional issues. And plus, you know, again, we're going back to the Supreme Court nominee, we've arrived at this situation where the judiciary thinks that they just, you know, can, you know, change everything in America essentially by fiat. So, you know, there would have to be some sort of demand, I think, for people to, you know, require that of Republican leaders or, you know, any leader in this country, and there just isn't. Now, having said that, I will say that one of the good things that did come out of the Tea Party, at least within the Republican Party, was that it did create an awareness of these specific constitutional issues. And a lot of the up-and-coming Republican politicians, Ted Cruz is actually a good example, you know, other guys like Tom Cotton, Ben Sasse, Mike Lee in the Senate, really are, you know, great, articulate constitutionalists, guys that take this stuff very seriously, talk about it quite deliberately. And in a lot of cases, like Mike Lee and Ben Sasse in particular, I'm thinking about, if you listen to their stem speeches when they were actually running for Senate, and since then, they actually like took those opportunities to not just like persuade people to vote for them, but they did so on constitutional grounds by saying what they would do and how they understood and respected the Constitution. And this is very positive. But again, that's the one problem with, you know, one of the many problems with the Trump phenomenon, which is that this particular emphasis in the Republican Party was sort of like growing and the strain of constitutionalists was growing. And Trump has just come along and, like everything else, just, you know, sort of washed all that, you know, away. The sort of Tea Party focus on constitutionalism has just gotten totally lost in the shuffle compared to Trump's, you know, vague nationalism and populism. You know, Trump wants to make America great again, but he doesn't understand that what made America great was the Constitution itself. So I don't know how you fix that.
There's also the issue, though, that people are focusing on what Donald Trump has said related to the First Amendment. He's clearly is antagonistic toward the press. He punishes the press publicly and privately for not writing fawning pieces about him. He also controls the press, and to a large degree he has them at his beck and call, and he can get them to do almost anything they want. He has made comments that are very scary about opening up libel laws to go after any press that criticizes him, he says, unfairly. But people in the media really reacted to this. This is a huge threat. This is tremendously scary. At the same time, both of the candidates on the Democratic side of the aisle have said, to me, far more alarming things, in that they are things that might actually happen. I don't think Donald Trump has much odds of, I don't think he understands how government works or the Constitution works. So I don't think he understands what he can and can't do. That is scary in and of itself. I think Hillary Clinton does know what she can do, and she has promised to have a litmus test for her Supreme Court nominee, that whoever she nominates must oppose the First Amendment on the Citizens United case. The Citizens United case was a very important political speech case of recent years that actually was about Hillary Clinton. A group had criticized her, and they were their speech was under threat because it happened prior to an election, and there were certain laws about whether you could actually speak against a candidate prior to her election. They won that case. It's an extremely important case that we'd be allowed to speak against politicians. And it actually dealt with Hillary Clinton. She says she opposes it. So does Bernie Sanders, who has other constitutional problems. And the media seem to treat that so cavalierly, like it's no big deal. They freak out about Donald Trump. I freak out about what Donald Trump says about the First Amendment, too. But let's keep some perspective about who's the threat and who can actually accomplish what they claim they want to accomplish.
Well, Molly's right about Citizens United and the threat it posed to the First Amendment. In fact, one of the most famous incidents in that case was when the Deputy Solicitor General, who working for the Obama administration, was arguing before the Supreme Court. One of the liberal justices, in fact, asked if, you know, under these campaign finance laws that they wanted to protect, would it be possible for the government to step in and ban books? And the Solicitor General said yes. I mean, which even horrified the liberal justices on the Supreme Court. So the threat from this was obviously clear in First Amendment terms. But the Citizens United case is also a classic example of how people don't understand the Constitution and, you know, how these things actually work. Because I think the understanding of this among the Democratic base and a lot of moderates who like campaign finance laws and things like that is simply a fuzzy one. They want money out of politics, and they don't want, you know, rich people to have too much influence. And it seems like a noble goal, but the solution they're proposing is essentially to gut the First Amendment. But, you know, nobody has any sort of clarity of understanding about, you know, how this would or would not, these campaign finance laws would or would not work with the Constitution. You know, if you phrased it to them as, you know, you realize this will gut the First Amendment, you know, they might be appalled, but the media never explain it this way because they don't understand the logical connection. And, you know, to the extent that maybe Hillary Clinton does, that the case was all about criticizing her, she's keeping her mouth shut. So it really is a situation where there does need to be some sort of broad-based educational effort here. But, you know, the media sure isn't going to do it.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at the Weekly Standard and the Federalist, respectively, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank you very much for being our guest.
Absolutely.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you.
Thanks again.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll get a review of the movie The Young Messiah from Pastor Ted Giese. That should be interesting. We'll also find Christ in Deuteronomy chapter 32 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is called Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? And it really does that. It actually, in the first half of the book, answers the question, what does it mean to teach the faith at home? And then in the second half, it answers the question, how is this done? The whole second half of the book is essentially a parent's manual for teaching the six chief parts, the truths of the Christian faith in Luther's Small Catechism, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, absolution, and the Lord's Supper at home with your own family. You can find out more about this great resource called Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? At our website, issuesetc.org. It's on every page of the website, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House, their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Teaching the Faith at Home. What does this mean? How is this done? From Concordia Publishing House. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Here's what Kitty in Lawrenceville, Georgia, had to say about last summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
I wanted to let you know that my favorite part of this year's conference was being part of the live show of Issues Etc. I will always remember just clapping and being a part of that show.
You can find out more about the 2016 Making the Case conference Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th in Collinsville, Illinois at issuesetc.org.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the divine service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.